My name is Paul. I am an addict.
Hey, Paul.
Simply an addict. I don't have a long monologue when I say that. I just say, I was taught I'm simply an addict. I'm just an addict. The topic that I'm very grateful for the committee for choosing me. I feel very honored to be a workshop speaker at the HACNA convention. Awakening of the Spirit. What a great theme for a convention. And it's great to be here. I love seeing all my old friends. I hadn't seen in 3 years. You know, pandemic and everything shut down. And now we're back in full force, back in hugging arms. But my topic is from the Living Clean book, which we helped write, by the way. You get with the ad hoc committee and you get the printouts when they come in and we make changes or, hey, why don't you add this? So this literature is, I was part of one of the first books that I helped. I wouldn't say critique or help write, but I was there in the process when this book was written. So it means a lot to me. On page 24, connection to ourselves. It can take a long time to set ourselves free. When we come to recovery, we have been devastated in many ways. Although living clean isn't all about crisis, it can sometimes seem that way. Our feelings are so powerful, there is so much change in our lives, and change can be messy even when it's positive. Our personalities and our sense of who we were warped by our addiction, and when we get clean, we are even more confused. This is me. It can be a while before we have an opportunity or the need to ask, okay, who am I now? We change in recovery, but we also uncover who we were all along. We find ourselves. For many of us, this is the restoration the second step talks about. It may even be the restoration to a state we've never experienced before, because we've never had the chance to be ourselves without pretending, without hiding, without trying to be something else. Okay, I read the whole paragraph because there's so much in that paragraph. And I am from McAllen, Texas, originally, born and raised. My clean date is January 10th, 2010. That is not my first clean date. I first came into the program in May of May 26, 2006, when I was introduced to a different way of life. And I had no idea what was going to happen. I was just sick and tired of being sick and tired. I got on a bus, went to Corpus Christi. I got off, a stranger in a strange land. I felt like an alien. I had been to Corpus maybe twice in my life. And they told me I was going to a rehab. And when I went to that rehab, I had two bags. Had a Monopoly game, some towels, underwear, coloring books, deck of cards, and some t-shirts. That's all I had left. I stayed at a shelter. My bed opened up. I got into rehab, and then y'all showed up. Wow. You know, a whole different set of people that I was introduced to. I don't have any drug or I would say jail stories or being locked up in prison. I don't have that experience. I don't have any felonies. So when I came in and I met y'all, I felt a little bit like, wow. You know, I didn't have any tattoos, you know, and I felt less than. I didn't use what, you know, when I first heard people share in an NA meeting, I was like, I didn't use like that. I don't have those felonies. My kids weren't taken away. And I was looking for all the things that would set me apart from. And But one person said, was talking about feelings and emotions, how they felt, how when they used the emotions they went through, which led them to use, and then the feelings afterwards. And I could key on that. You know, it talks about in our literature where empathy becomes a healing factor for those in recovery. And that I felt the same way they felt, miserable. You know, I felt the shame of using, the shame that I had for my family. I felt embarrassed that I could have gone, I could have been a contender, you know, could have gone plus some places. You know, I had dreams and aspirations. I didn't sit in high school thinking, oh, I can't wait till I become a drug addict. You know, that was not my plan, you know. And as I listened to people share in the rooms of Narcotics Anonymous, I can identify. You know, I didn't have to have all the felonies. I didn't have to have all the tattoos. I didn't have to have the Harley Davidson rolling in. You know, I just had to feel the same way they felt when they used. I had to that deeper level of understanding of what that lifestyle had done to me, the drugs and out the drugs. And so I started falling in love with Narcotics Anonymous. And I made decision then and there to stay in Corpus because there was no NA in McAllen. And I felt like I was becoming a different person. And for the first couple of years, I felt like I had to prove something. You know, I did. I felt like you had to know who I was. Or I had to pretend to be somebody who I really wasn't. This tough guy. You know, they have a standing joke in Corpus that usually when I start to share, they would bring me Kleenex, you know, because I would start crying. And that, yeah, for years I've been doing that because what Narcotics Anonymous has done for me is so emotional. The feelings I have of gratitude, kind of like what Brandon was talking about. I owe Narcotics Anonymous a debt I can never repay. And so that change that the reading talks about, that I'm not that same person that I was when I came into treatment and I went to Narcotics Anonymous for the first time. I'm not that same person I was 3 years later when I relapsed and I went out drinking. I have 12 years clean now, and time flies. I remember when I relapsed and how I felt, you know, and I didn't like that feeling. I didn't like going to a convention and then everybody say, oh, 3 years clean. And they stand up and they get in line, everybody's cheering. And I'm sitting there, you know, 20 days clean. You know, I didn't like that feeling. And I told myself, I'm not gonna use just for today. I'm not going to use. And before you know it, time flies. It took me a while to get over that resentment to myself. You know, when I was like, I should be up there with that person with, you know, 10 years clean. I'm like, wow. But that helped remind me not to use. So that change does not come overnight. Throughout my clean time, throughout this process of discovery, I've had to learn about my shortcomings and my defects. And I had to learn that I can rely on others. You know, there's a part of me, one of my character defects is I suffer from low self-esteem. I feel less than. And when I feel that way, I feel overwhelmed. Sometimes I forget to turn to the very thing that will help me recover, which is y'all. And so I implode. I close in on myself. And several times I've had to have guys come to my door. Jimmy, Uncle Phil, what? Troy, police knock on my door. Paul, get out of your cell. You know, my parents would call them to come break me out from that depression. And that's happened several times. It hasn't happened in the last 3 years. You know, and kind of like when the pandemic hit and everything shut down, I was like, oh, perfect. I can just hibernate and, you know, it's right up my alley. But what I did do during that time was I jumped into the Zoom platform. And I wanted to get back involved in Narcotics Anonymous. And And right now, I do several service positions. I'm the regional PR chair, which I get the message out. I fulfill that primary purpose, carry the message of Narcotics Anonymous. I do that for the regional level, and also do it for the area level. And I'm on several convention committees, and that gives me some accountability. So I was like, I can't just lay in bed and watch Oprah all day. I got to get up and make a flyer. I got to do stuff, you know? And so Narcotics Anonymous has given me a new purpose in life. And I see the importance of that purpose because some, you know, it's not arrogance. It's I feel like if I'm not giving the message out that I'm hoarding my recovery and I'm not doing what this program tells me to do because I have to pay it back. Like Brandon was talking about. So I can't hibernate anymore. I can't feel sorry for myself. I'm right where I need to be, you know? Yeah, I beat myself up for over a long time of who I thought I should have been. But that was what I thought I should have been. That wasn't what God had in mind. So when I continue to fight that where I think I should be, that's when I go into that depression. I think I can control my life. But the plan that the God of my understanding has put me in that path is completely different. And I realize now that every time I would fight it, I would put myself in a deep depression. So I'm not crying because I'm sad. I'm crying because I get emotional when I share because I know who I used to be, you know, and I'm not that same person I am today. I don't know how much time I have, but
10 minutes.
10 minutes? Okay.
12.
12? Oh my gosh. But but that change did not come overnight. That change came with revelation and going to meetings and going to conventions and being a part of. I couldn't pick this up through what they say osmosis.
Osmosis.
But they call it osmosis because my ass sitting on a chair.
Oh, I see.
And I pick it up from my predecessors, those who have faced our dilemma and found a way out. And it's not just a way out of drugs. It's a way out of self. It's a way out of being afraid. It's a way of not being productive. And I've learned from so many men and women in this program the benefits of staying clean. I don't have to settle, like Jimmy says, for the bologna sandwich. I get the steak sandwich. Well, how free do you want to be? Like what Brandon was talking about. How free do you really want to be? And that was such a he shared about something that I feel like I need to get back into, and that's it's a 12-step program. I need to get back into the steps. I need to do this again. And the thing about the steps is when I first started working then with my first sponsor, it was all about the drugs. You know, and now it's a lot different because I've changed from that person. I'm not I haven't put drugs or anything in my body in 12 years. So it's about those feelings and emotions and that self-destructive personality that needs to change. And I suffer from that. And that paragraph was written, that was written to me. Change came necessary. Those self-destructive patterns that I have are so evident. And y'all, and when we see them, I'm not the only one that sees them. Everybody else sees them. And my family is so grateful to Narcotics Anonymous. They're grateful to my friends in Narcotics Anonymous who hold me accountable. They love Jimmy. Mm-hmm. How's Jimmy doing? How's Troy doing? How's Ed doing? You know, all the people that my family knows that help their son in life, you know. And it's because of this fellowship that I've been able to grow and change, you know. I want to just close with this, that when they gave me this topic, like a new way to live, it always reminds me of page 107, the chapter More Will Be Revealed, And I've, and it's one of my, you know, page, of course, page 89 and page 15 and page, I mean, I can go on, but page 107, it's something that I hold dear. It says, Narcotics Anonymous offers an addict a program of recovery that is more than just a life without drugs. Not only is this way of life better than the hell we lived, it is better than any life that we have ever known. I get to live twice. I get to be reborn, like Brandon was talking about. If I could take it all back, I really wouldn't. I would just, this is who I was meant to be at this moment in time because of Narcotics Anonymous. And the more I fight it, the more I rebel, the more I think I can take it back, that step three, I'm not restored to sanity. I'm restored to insanity. And I don't have to live like that anymore. So I am truly grateful to Narcotics Anonymous. Sorry that I get emotional. You know, I'm not really sorry. No, I'm not sorry. That's just who I am. That's you right. know. Thank you for letting me share.
Thanks, Paul.
Okay. Thank you, Paul, for sharing your experience. Thank you.
Okay, I'm Aubrey H., a grateful recovering addict. A long intro. And my clean date is 7/19/19. And I always say my clean date because I don't want to take it for granted. So I'm going to, you know, the topic is the same, or it says there is so much change in our lives. So I'm going to kind of read in between. So I got into programs like these, 12-step programs like these, in 2001. I'm 36 years old. So when I got here, I was pretty young, right? I didn't get to this fellowship. This was not, I couldn't find these rooms as frequent as the other fellowship, but nonetheless, I got here when I was, at 14 years old. And when I got here, the only thing it did was ruin my high for the rest of my using days. Because I was 14, I wasn't ready, you know. I had just had like a friend of mine that was 16, and he was like, "You're worse than me." And I was just starting off. I didn't know what he was talking about, but he said, "Let's go to this meeting." I don't know. I've seen him on movies and stuff, and let's like, there's a real one that we can go to. And I was like, "Okay, I'll check it out." And I get there, and it's actually an NA meeting. It's in a group that's still around, or a club, I should say. It's called Up the Street Club in Clear Lake area. They had NA there, they had AA there, and GA there, and at the time. But anyway, so that was my first little experience with 12-step recovery. I got out of that. So what? Let me back up. My whole, I guess, changes happened, or from what I can remember, as I was 10 years old and my parents got divorced. Sorry. I was 10, my sister was 8, my brother was 6, and of course, or not of course, but I took on the feelings of, this is all my fault, right? I felt like, what could I have done differently? How can I save this, right? And my life was, that was a pivotal moment in my life where I thought my life was crumbling around me. Like, I had zero control, right? I had no way of changing it because I tried to beg with my mom. My mom was the one that wanted it, not my dad. And I'm not going to get into the details really because we don't have but the point was, is I just felt like I had lost all control of my outside world and could not do anything to change it. And it happened so fast, you know. My mom told me that she's leaving my dad 2 weeks later. He's moved out. The next man's moved in. And I'm like, oh, that's how I met the guy. He was a Green Beret in the military, never had any kids. And I know my mom was number 5 because when they would get mad at each other, she would say, "You'll be looking for number 6. So my mom was number 5. And so the guy was like, really high strung and I was really rebellious. So putting us together, it was like atomic bomb. He was controlling and I felt like I was losing control. So that was also really lethal. And what happened for me in that situation is he would have me like, I was literally like an enlistee. Okay. I had to mow the lawn with a backpack of bricks on. My sister and brother, if they made any mistakes, I would get hit for it. I was put in the middle of the room and they would have to watch me be hit. He called me the leader of the pack. So if I made a mistake, obviously I was hit too. And we were hit with like belts. And so I was mentally, physically, emotionally abused as a child. I started losing interest in things. I stopped, you know, I'm naturally extroverted. I started closing up, you know, school, my nurse noticed it. One thing he would have me do is clean up after everybody that ate every time, which I understand people have chores, but he would stand over my shoulder and nitpick and micromanage. And I had enough. And he's like, well, if you don't eat, you don't have to clean. And I said, okay, well then I'm not going to eat. So I stopped eating. And I felt like that was my first glimpse of having some control back. Right. I was like, okay, well, good. So I wouldn't eat. And he called me fat and piggy and all this stuff and told me I needed a nose job. And so, what started happening is I developed an unhealthy relationship with food and people. Food and men. My mom wasn't really there enough. Now I'm going to cry all. My mom wasn't really there enough. And, oh God. Okay. I stopped eating, but of course, you know, that's not sustainable. So I would have to eat at night and I would sneak out of the room. And we had the house was an upside down house. So the kitchen and the master was upstairs and all the bedrooms were downstairs. And the stairs were freaking creaky. So I had to like really Jedi ninja myself up the stairs without creaking the stairs to get the food so I could eat it. And I started doing that and it became a routine and he was like, oh, she may be eating at night. And, anyway, we got into a lot of fights and I did that for a long time. And around 13 years old, I got taken out of there from CPS and I moved in with I was sent to my dad's house. So I just want to give you a backstory on that. So my first issue was, or my first, addiction or mess was with food. And then when I was in these hospitals from 11 to 13, in and out for eating disorder, you know, back then it wasn't really as understood, kind of taboo. And I was stuck into psychiatric units. And don't get me wrong, I would attempt, you know, suicide for sheer attention from my dad and mom because I felt like I wasn't getting enough. But I would be sent to psychiatric units. And this was another pivotal thing that I remember shaped my life. I was an adolescent in the psych ward. I was 13 years old. And they mixed the psychiatric patients with the drug addicts, adolescent drug addicts. And because our counselor or whatever wasn't there that day. And I remember this blonde girl. And she was a little heavier set and she was crying. And she said, I was so skinny when I did tweak. And me, I'm like, ding, like, what is this? You know, this is a new solution. Cause I was counting calories. I was chewing my food up, spitting it out. I was standing in a bathroom with the shower on and wrapped in cellophane so I could lose water weight. I was still in laxatives and diuretics from the store at, you know, 14, 13. And I was just like, God, there's got to be something else, something different. And sorry. And so, you know, I just didn't know. I just didn't know who I was or what I was doing. I was just trying to find my identity in this world. And I knew exactly when I got out of there, I went and looked for this, and I knew older people in my neighborhood, and they didn't find me that. But my first drug to ever try at 13 years old was cocaine. And they told me it was going to help me lose weight. And then it stopped working. It turned on me in 3 weeks, and I had to find something different. And I finally found Tweak, and I did that. And, you know, and I was doing that all the time. And I was in modeling when I was younger, so I was getting paid for that. I actually would work with my mom. She did real estate. She would have to sneak to pick me up because my stepdad was such a controlling maniac that he didn't want her to hang out with me. And they had a multi-million-dollar company together, so she didn't want to leave him. So she snuck around with me like I was another man, which is freaking crazy. So what time is it? Sorry. Okay. I went through this situation where I transferred my obsession from food and calorie counting and body dysmorphia to drugs. I was in my first treatment center at 14 years old. I went to the Odyssey House. They're a sister company of Cinecor, so they're strict. Back then, for sure. I get there. I'm a kid that really just thinks the world owes me something. I get there and they ask me to do chores and sweep. I didn't know how to do that. You know, like I folded clothes beforehand and I cleaned the kitchen, but maybe I just didn't want to do it. I don't know, but I got there and I remember getting like so irritated with them. And I remember how entitled and how bitchy I was at that age. And I left after a week and my dad would complain to me, that's $800 a day I had to pay. Blah, blah, blah. Insurance didn't kick in yet. And, you know, so I'm starting to be a tornado in people's lives financially. And I get there and I leave and then I go out and I still do my thing. I still use. I'm sneaking out at night, you know, doing the whole thing. School, I had gotten sexually assaulted and by a football player at my school. So they asked my dad to move me to different schools. That was interesting. And so I was in and out. I was in 5 different high schools. And whenever I'd go back to treatment, I went back to the Odyssey House again at 15. I stayed there. I turned 16 in there. It was a long-term treatment program. I stayed clean 17 months. And I didn't do any step work, though. I had a sponsor who was a runway model, and she was real attractive to me. She was an NA sponsor, but we never did any step work because social acceptability doesn't equal recovery, right? And this book tells us that. I had zero foundation. I went to meetings, but I didn't make any progress in service work. I wasn't doing any step work. I wasn't getting outside of myself. I was just like, oh, I have a cool sponsor that's a runway model, and she shot dope like me, and she freaking threw up too. So what a, you know, double whammy. And I did, you know, and so what happened is the minute I, like, shit didn't go my way and, you know, life happened, I went and drank a bunch of dry gin and got throwed off and went right back to the swing of things. you know, and I started shooting dope at 16 years old. And I told myself, I'm not staying clean and committing to this program until after I try that, because I've got to try it all. So that was my first goal in life. And then, you know, the cool thing, let me back up on another goal. The cool thing about being here at this convention and my name being on the schedule, I saw that and I was like, my dream came true. I can remember. I can remember at 15 years old, because I'd be coming to these meetings, right? And I wasn't clean, but I would still come to these meetings. And I'm like, one day I'm going to be there. I'm going to be up there talking. You know, that was my dream. small steps, right? I'm doing a workshop. But when I saw that, I was like, I text my daughter and I was like, Mom, one of Mommy's dreams came true. It's off my bucket list. My kid's so supportive. She's 15. She's like, woohoo, Mom. She's like, you got this, boo. And I was like, okay, baby. She's so cute. But, okay. So, you know, the thing is like, I'm just trying to find my identity, trying to find my place in this world. I'm always in the back of my mind thought one day I'll get clean. It's just not today. You know, like I don't think I'm going to die. It's just not, I'm just not getting clean today. And I would show up and I'd find myself in different treatment centers. You know, I did end up going to Senecor. I went to the Right Step several times. I went to Memorial Hermann several times, the park. And I just, you know, same shit, different year, right? The book tells us that self-knowledge isn't going to keep us clean. People aren't going to keep us clean. Clean time's not going to keep us clean. And fear's not going to keep us clean. And so, you know, I was running off of all of that, trying to stay clean. I wasn't connecting to a higher power. I wasn't connecting to people. I wasn't connecting with myself. And so this chapter is so cool because it says the ties that bind us. And it talks about, it says, we don't think our way into a new way of living. We live our way into a new way of thinking. And so this is a program of action. And it talks about connecting to ourselves. It talks about connecting to our higher power. It talks about connecting to our world around us. And it talks about us connecting with each other in this program. So that's like opposite of where I was in the depths of my addiction. And so it says here, you know, in this book, and I love this book, and I didn't get the opportunity to critique it, but I was part of the SPAD, which comes out in November 2022, y'all. Spiritual Principles a Day book. But it says at some point, our identity as using addicts came to define us. You know, and I got to the point where I was like, God, I'm probably going to die with a needle in my arm. Like, that's where I got. I no longer thought one day I'll get clean, just not today. I started thinking that I was going to die. And I was accepting that. I was okay with that. I took out life insurance policies for my kids because, you know, I had kids at 21 and 23 and they're 13 and 15 today. Well, not, you know, And I always made that payment. So I did always make that payment to that life insurance policy because I didn't want my parents screwed. I didn't want my kids screwed. And at the end of the day, they would have been really sad and terrible if I died. But I just wanted to make sure that something was there to help my parents. It says at some point, our identity as using addicts came to define us. At the end of the road, it seemed like we were nothing but our addiction. As we stay clean, we begin to discover who we are. And so I get, you know, I get clean on 7/19/19, and my sponsor, Laura J, is right there. Oh, that's my angel next, you know, to the higher power. I mean, she's not my higher power, but she's up there on, you know, the top five special people to me. And you know, I get here and I want to tell you that I still went to college. I still went to college shooting dope. I did 9 years on a 4-year degree. So it took me a while, but I was determined. I was like, I spent all this money. I didn't get scholarships. I got there. I had no clue what an exponent was. I didn't know anything about math. I graduated from a high school that doesn't exist anymore or have any accreditation. I turned in books. My dad paid him $800 a month, and I learned nothing. So when I got to college, I got there on an eighth grade level. I started in a community college. So when I found out I was pregnant with Bree Lynn, I did actually dedicate myself to staying clean. I didn't go to any lengths of doing any service work or step work again, y'all. I stayed dry. I went to a few meetings here and there, but you know, they say meeting makers make it. No, meeting makers make it to the next meeting. That's my experience. I made it to every meeting, but I made them there high. I mean, people, places, and things cannot keep me clean. So, you know, I found out I was pregnant. right after I got out of CentiCorps, nonetheless. I was there for like 5 months. I could not do the 2-year program. And I started dedicating myself to school and to doing something different. I didn't use when I was pregnant with Breland. Once I found out, I did use in the beginning, but I didn't know I was pregnant. Not that that makes me any different or any better. I'm just giving you my story. So I stayed dry. I'm sorry if it's too much information, but I breastfed. So I decided, you know, I would drink and then I'd have to pump the milk and dump it. And I just felt so guilty. So I just didn't really drink. Then I got pregnant with my next kid and I stayed for about 4 years, just drinking here and there, right? And like I said, used in the beginning. Once I had Ashlyn and I had a foot operation, 2 months later, I was off to the races. Like I never even stopped. Back to banging dope and doing all that. But in that time period, I was able to put a little schoolwork together. I started going back to meetings again because I thought, oh God, I'm going to, you know, screw my life up. So I always knew meetings were there. It was safe, but I was always on the fringes. I was never in the middle. I was never the one doing the coffee or helping chair meetings or just even talking to newcomers. I just was always like on the outside looking in. Wow, am I on time? 12 minutes. 12 minutes? Okay, perfect. So I get here broken, hopeless, like all of us, I'm sure, have, right? And, the thing that got me here this time and not, it, you know, it wasn't me running around my subdivision naked thinking CPS helicopters were after me and all these crazy things we do, right? I mean, I did some crazy things. my drugs is a choice for meth and heroin banging them. So, you know, I was either nodding out or thinking somebody was next to me or trying to cut me. One or the other was my state of mind. And so when I got here, I actually had gotten a job, y'all, and I used during that job. I was like trying to just use pills. And I was stealing from my coworker, watching her on Teams when she would leave her cubicle. I'd go and jack all of her pills in it. And so I was like, I'm going to lose this career because it was a career. I had a 401k. I had benefits. Like I had to keep my mind, right? But that stuff doesn't keep us clean. So I got to the point when I met Laura, I was walking my daughter, Ashlyn, up the hill of this bridge. And we were coming back from bike rides. And I was in this tunnel vision, this state of mind. I remember it distinctly. I was contemplating which vehicle I was going to jump in front of because I wanted to kill myself and I didn't want to get paralyzed because I'm a selfish motherfucker. I just wanted to get killed. And I was at Ashlyn there and she's like, Mom, what are you staring at? And I just snapped out of it. But I was literally thinking about it. And that was the lowest point and the most hollow. And I felt, I had this like epiphany. Like I'm just a shell of a person. You know, because it's even worse when I'm prescribed to these medications, but I can go to multiple doctors, but I'm still in it, right? It's like this, you can't die, but you feel miserable and derelict, but you can't die because, well, either way. Well, now you can because they put fentanyl and everything, but, you know, I got clean before that. And anyway, I just want to say that I got to the rooms of NA and I've only picked up one white key tag because I never picked up a key tag before. And I'm grateful for that. I started chairing a meeting at 60 days because nobody else could do it. Or nobody else would do it. I'm sorry. I chaired that meeting for a year. And then I started calling it my meeting. And I knew Tradition 2 needed to kick in. And we needed to rotate it out, right? Because I sat on a stage and I called it my meeting. And yeah. And so ego was kicking in. So, you know, I started getting sponsees to take it over, and that was awesome. My sponsor told me I could sponsor women as long as I didn't let them catch up to me. So I started sponsoring people at six, when I was on step 6. It was a life changer for me. It reminded me where I was. You know, it kept it fresh. Plus, it kept me motivated. And that's been the best thing for me. I started being GSR for Ties That Bind Us at 1 Year Clean. I now just transferred out of that position, so I took it for 2 years. And I do HASO, as you were mentioning, for the last 2 years. That's great. I get a lot of pleasure, a lot of God out of service work. The big change for me this time is God became my friend and no longer my acquaintance. So God was always my acquaintance and never my friend. And I was like, if I'm going to build a relationship with a higher power, I got to be fucking friends with it. I can't just say, hey, what's up, homie, and then like fucking leave and never check in. And so I started becoming a friend to God. And God, I started a meeting and it's still thriving, thank God. I was worried. If you're ever in Houston or you live in Houston, it's when Fridays at 7 p.m. It's called We Do Recover. It's at 3925 Tacoma Street. That has been so rewarding for me to do that. This is the opposite of what I always did. I got into service work, you know? It says that after years clean, we experience ourselves differently than we did in the beginning. As we develop an identity beyond addict, we wonder whether that label still applies. So I did get complacent at one point, you know? And I had to come back and just go back to the basics. During COVID, we got on Zoom and Ty's got on Zoom and all that. So I'm just grateful that I woke up today. I'm grateful. Oh, I do a gratitude list. I've been doing that for 2 years. If you want to be on the list, I'll send it to you every morning. And I appreciate when people send it back to me. But that's been so freaking rewarding, y'all. Because I feel like a grateful addict will never use. And that's a guarantee. As long as I stay grateful, I stay clean. I'm going to read this last part. No matter how far we have come, when we live clean, the journey continues. And that's all I have.